Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, in memory of Edward Said, who died in September 2003, we're rebroadcasting this conversation that first aired in January 2002. Said's many books include Beginnings, Intention and Method, Orientalism, and Culture and Imperialism. Out of Place, a Memoir, and The Said Reader are available from Vintage. Edward Said studied literature at Columbia University, where he also taught for most of his life. During this conversation, Mr. Said is speaking by phone from his office at Columbia University in New York City.
I have a funny relationship myself with the work of Mr. Said. I was a graduate student in the State University of New York at Buffalo, and for the entire year before his first major post-dissertation work appeared, we were receiving, as if urgent missives, chapters of Edward Said's Beginning, Intention and Method to read. The book was expected by my professors, among them Eugenio Donato, René Girard, Homer Brown, to be the next step in what was then hermeneutical criticism. While Beginnings opened the door and oversaw a huge territory of possibilities in literary criticism, it was Said's next book, Orientalism, that by choosing a particular entrance really did revolutionize the field of literary criticism, bringing in what now is known as post-colonial criticism. What followed were works that brought Said as an intellectual into the forefront of cultural commentary. His books began to alternate between commentaries on the politics of Palestinians and their world situation, literary criticism, works on the position of the intellectual, how he represents himself and fails to, works that were thrilling in essentially redefining what would become literary study and political study in our time. In a sense, I want to begin at the beginning and ask you, Mr. Said, about Joseph Conrad, because I know that has been an identification that's very rich and deep. And I know that you identify with Conrad himself as an exile figure and as a figure who is caught between cultures and languages.
Well, I think the character of the narrator in Conrad, and I suppose Conrad himself as a figure who I had studied not only in his novels but also in his letters, a persona who was always on the edge of one situation or another and not totally inhabiting one or the other. That's what caught my eye and has really gripped me ever since.
Now, from the very beginning in that first book, you do what becomes characteristic, I think, of Said in his criticism. You essentially widen the field and say that the letters are necessary to an understanding of the fiction, and in fact that there's a back-and-forth quality between the letters and the fiction that help us to understand what you define as Conrad's agony. You quote him famously as having said, "I am a living nightmare." It's that opening into the text outside and the world outside the text that brought the focus of literary criticism from what used to be called autotelism, the perfect work, the internal world of the perfect work, into the much wider world first of the author's letters and private consciousness. You were involved with the works of the Geneva critics, but then beyond that into philosophy, politics, history. And I wondered how it is you have managed to feel the confidence to enter all of those various fields beyond the literary.
I'm not sure whether it's confidence or foolhardiness, but it's a kind of, I guess, underlying conviction, which is borne out by everybody's life. That is to say that, you know, whatever one does, there are always connections between that and a host of other things. And that's what's so fascinated me, the fact that we're all involved in a kind of web of constantly evolving connections, whether you call that history or whether you call that context or society. And it seems to me that, you know, to be the most inviting, perhaps the most difficult, but certainly the most rewarding of all researches, to try to understand the connections between things that seem to be isolated. And throughout everything that I've written, you know, the people who I've been most interested in, who have remained, like Conrad, who was able to see, for example, that sitting in London and talking about Africa, in the end, you know, Africa and London become, in a sense, part of the same configuration. Two great critics like Erich Auerbach, the author of Mimesis, who was able to see the connection between a fragment of a text, say, by Apuleius or Petronius, and connect that to the situation of the Roman Empire as a whole. Or, you know, Vico, another great figure for me, the Neapolitan philosopher of the 18th century, who sees all of human history as, in its details, reflecting all other things.
Well, it is interesting, because I know that I felt, when reading Mimesis for the first time, and I read the chapter contrasting Homer's method of representation with that of the Old Testament, I felt that, in fact, it was a revelation, that Auerbach was capable of bringing me an understanding, a perspective, on how different cultures see or saw and continue to see the world, similar to that sort of stroke of severing in Orientalism, where you say these scholars have been describing a world of their own construction, finding their desires there, recapitulating it. Did you know that that book, at a stroke, would organize a whole school of critical studies in response to it?
No, not at all. I mean, I was sort of buried. I wrote the book. I did a lot of the research in New York and while teaching and so on, but I then got a free year, and I was in the most ideal circumstances, never replicated again. I was at a Center for Advanced Study in Stanford, in Palo Alto, in California, and I had, you know, no obligations to teach or do anything. There were no phones in the offices or anything, and I just sat there with this enormous amount of material, and I then became aware of how much of a private fantasy a lot of it was, and it had, and how little it had to do with the actual experience of being what they would have called, of course, an Oriental. I mean, it had very, and I think that's the key thing for me, is always to get at the experience that's in the language. And very frequently language can produce a sense of the experience, but it can also exclude it. And that's what I thought Orientalism was. You know, it was an act of incorporation that banned a lot of stuff because it didn't fit a preconceived idea of what the Orient was. And when I finished it, you know, I showed it to a few friends, and I had literally no idea what would come of it until, by chance, it was read by, it was one of these extraordinary happenings, you know, serendipitous things. And, you know, I had a small, tiny contract with the University of California Press, which gave me the princely advance of $250 to write something like that. And by the end of the year, I had produced this quite large manuscript, which is shown at a dinner to a publisher, who then offered me, I don't know, $10,000 or something, you know, to publish it. And it was rapidly what is the word, transformed from something into something else. And I realized that what I'd really been talking about was the conflict of experiences and how they could be rendered over a long period of time and how they could be made, I mean, how the encounter could be made fruitful in many other ways. And that's what happened afterwards, I suppose. It was taken up and very, you know, by the early 80s had been translated into many languages and was part of a large debate, most of which I wasn't able to follow. No, I mean, you know, it's impossible after a while.
Yes,
it's still going on, by the way.
Yes, it outgrew its source.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It became, you know, a book in the Balkans. It was completely different from the book I had written. In China, it became another book. In Japan, another book. In Malaysia, yet another book. In France, another. And so it went. It was quite an extraordinary thing. I mean, it shouldn't happen. I mean, it happened so rarely, but it did in this instance.
Well, it was interesting because for me, it was a moment in literary criticism that went from the kind of writing, for better and for worse, that Poulet did and the aesthetics of space, Bachelard. One would often call these works meditations, and their poetic diction, and their certain reverence for reverie, would create a mood of criticism that was quite beautiful and transfixing. But suddenly, these would surely have been called your works, provocations or interventions.
Yes, because I mean, the situation I was in was there lurking. I mean, I begin the book as I began the writing of the book. You know, during the opening year of the Lebanese Civil War, which was a kind of pendant to the wars of the middle 60s, and certainly the 67 war. And where you can actually experience, as people now perhaps are experiencing at this moment, the transformation of a world into another one, you know, beyond recognition by cataclysmic or major events. And you have a change in consciousness. And what I was watching was, I mean, I think I wrote, it was a very fortunate conjuncture because I was writing at the moment when that Orient, which had been a mainstay of European, especially European, but then I suppose other kinds of cultures too, for literally centuries, the East and so on, it was all coming apart. And the whole, that I think from that was born the idea that has really stayed with me. Past Orientalism and intercultural imperialism. So the fact that everything is now mixed, you can't make those separations anymore. You know, you have to find a way of dealing with those sometimes improbable or at least difficult to understand conjunctures, mixtures of East and West, you know, of modernity and tradition, of all the oppositions that we have been trained by education to think of as entirely separate. Well, they've suddenly collapsed. And what you have to deal with is, this mixture. And that presents a whole new set of problems.
I think one of the powers of the work, and that continues to make it very upsetting to its opponents or even its first readers, is although you describe Orientalism as a long manuscript, its effect is of enormous compression and brevity. And I think that brevity has characterized your work since, so that part of the effect of an essay like the essay on Jane Austen and imperialism is that in 20 pages you do a reading and a history of a book that, for instance, Avram Fleischman devoted an entire book to. The at-a-stroke quality, the slicing of the rope irrevocably, seems to be part of the strength of your political and your literary position.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting that you should mention that. It's very perceptive. I work in a way with a kind of urgency that is, I don't know, it comes from a worry of not being able to finish, of not being able to, not having the time to go through all the steps that you have to do a proper, you know, kind of scholarly, whatever it is, trajectory. And what I find, you know, something that I want to do is to engage the reader at a pace and at a level that can be immediately felt, rather than, you know, takes a great long time to get to the end of it and this sort of thing. So I suppose it, in part it's cinematic or documentary, rather than, you know, entirely meditative. And there too, I think the pressure of the world, which is a very important word for me, of worldliness, you know, the situation in which we live is very important.
But it's there, as you point out, in your point of origin, in the recent memoir, and very beautiful, by the way, thank you for it. You talk about the name Edward Said as immediately provoking astonishment and laughter. Edward after Prince Edward, yeah. Said, a name from who knows where, to say at a stroke that there are two worlds conjoined, mm-hmm. and no one can account for them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the probably then the big theme of my, of, I don't know, I wouldn't call it my work, that's too pretentious, of what I'm, the predicament I'm sort of constantly dealing with, and that is the fact that, you know, there are mixtures and situations and places that are not one thing entirely, but several. And I suppose at a very grandiose level, you could say that I feel myself very much to be between cultures, between languages. I have a whole, I've been thinking about this to write for the future. I've been thinking about, you know, what it's like to exist in more than one language, which is, in a sense, what I do, because I, you know, Arabic was the language of my youth and still is the language of intimacy and family. English is a language of, you know, training and teaching and being partly in the world. French is another language of that sort, and it's a very disorienting thing, because the instability of it is threatening, but also because they are in many ways at war. I mean, there is now whether one calls it that or not, there is a kind of antagonism between one of the places I come from and the place I live in. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's always been around me.
You're listening to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm speaking today with Edward Said. Now, it's been commented that the quintessential hero of the novel is an orphan, or at any rate, someone who doesn't know where he comes from, a foundling. And you comment as well that no one knows where the name Said came from. It's not a family name. Are you an orphan nomad hero of a novel, the novel of the world?
That's a very shrewd observation. Well, in a way, you know, because I it's not the classical notion of an orphan who doesn't know. Don't forget that in novels like Oliver Twist or even Tom Jones, mm-hmm. right, the orphan is an orphan at the beginning, but at the end discovers his or her parenthood. I mean, his genealogy is discovered in the course of the novel, and that's what the novel is for. And in a funny sort of way, that's also been true in my own life. I mean, I know that, you know, that my father, when he was in school, was called Wadia Ibrahim, which meant that he was Wadia, the son of Ibrahim. Said was a later addendum.
Where did it come from?
Well, I don't know. I still don't. I mean, my parents are dead. My oldest living relative on my father's side, who was also Said, is in his early 80s. I'm still very close to him. He lives in Toronto. And I've asked him. He said, I know where it came from. You know, it's just there. And it must be some common, I mean, it's a common enough name.
Yes,
it's
yes.
It's not an arcane or place name. And it means contented and happy.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's one of the names that is frequently, that goes through a lot of transformations in Arabic. You know, Said, Mas'ud, Sa'd, Said, they're all related to the same root, which is happiness, and been made happy, and so on. On the other hand, I know there's a very large network of family relationships, which I've now, not totally, but mostly mastered and figured out, so I'm not an orphan. I mean, I know there's, but this mysterious floating signifier. Saeed is still there, and I'm trying to exactly fix it, but I can't.
Now, the orphan questing for his identity has to constantly ask whether what he's being presented with by the people who would tell him who he is, whether they're telling him the truth. And so truth and lies become hugely important to this orphan character, it seems to me. And what's more, we're always being, in a sense, ensorcelled, convinced that we are the story that the person talking to us is telling us. The resistance to those stories, stories that novels tell, stories that cultures tell, seems to be a very crucial part of your work. Not so much distrust, but being in more or less an ontological position where trust is not possible.
Right, because they seem, as indeed they are, constructions. I mean, they are conveniently placed sequences of events that explain some things, but not everything. And, I realized through the early part of my life, and I talk about this in Out of Place, my memoir, that I was sort of playing a role in several of these stories that were given to me by my situation, by the peculiarity of the situation of my parents, where my father was an early immigrant to the United States from Palestine. He lived there, became an American, served in World War One, then came back to Palestine, and then was an American citizen who then moved to Egypt and, had business in Palestine and Egypt. And I went to colonial schools. I didn't really have much to do with the world, the historical world of my family, but rather this other world, which is another story of being in, getting an English education, a narrative that was given to me of England, in which I didn't fit, really, except as a wog. And that was unacceptable. So one had to keep examining and re-examining these stories, because they didn't fit. It was like the whole question of the Orient, which I talked about earlier, where I felt there was some discrepancy between my experience and what was said about a place called the Orient. And so, this endless examination and meditation, this archaeological looking for alternative explanations that would somehow explain why this narrative worked or didn't work, as the case may be, has really been, has really been very much a part of my life as long as I can remember. However, as I grow older, it takes more formal form, so that, the whole notion of investigation, which is absolutely central, and re-examination and re-excavation, is the core of it. But also implied in it is a rather terrifying possibility that you may never get to the bottom of it. That there is no underlying, stable, one truth. That's a kind of devastating thing to look for. But I suppose it has to do with mortality. In the end, you discover that human life itself is pretty precarious. And that's the form. And to accommodate to that, one creates, if one has the power, I don't. So you create ultimates and gods and paradises and hells and all the rest of it.
I wanted to end, in a sense, where we began with Conrad. I'm particularly thinking of the world that I'm walking around in, and I'm sure you are too, in New York, which seems to me to be the world of the secret agent, of things defined by murk, fog. In particular, objects seem to explode to life. I'm thinking of the player piano in The Secret Agent that shocks people. I think the name of the club is the Centauri, if I'm not mistaken. But when it plays, it's not by an appointed time. It seems to just start into life, having the effect, it's said that it explodes to life, of the bomb that the professor is carrying around, one thinks, never knowing when he'll use it. A world totally made precarious. And I wondered if at this moment you have any descriptions of how one lives in a world made precarious and unrecognizable.
Well, it's really the world I grew up in. I mean, I was 10 or 11 years old when the King David Hotel was blown up 300 yards from where I lived in Jerusalem. If I, you know, just to remember the effects of war and explosions during the period of the Lebanese Civil War, just to come to one very close to home, where my family lived, where my wife's family is, and where, you know, we went during the 17 or 18 years of that war with buildings blowing up, car bombs, missiles, rockets, explosions of all kinds. You know, it's a world, you know, of multiple recognitions of how precarious and how dangerous, and yet how over time one can accustom oneself to living in it. Because everything is like that in a way, you know. The onset of a grave illness, you know, is like suddenly discovering that you can't go on the way you did. You know, everything's changed. And those multiple adjustments and readjustments, these recognitions and then taking stock and then, you know, what always happens in Conrad, it takes a long time. It's a kind of delayed decoding of what's happening. The process of understanding are much, much slower. Is really the world that we have lived in. I mean, in America, you know, we've been shielded from it in some extraordinary way. I mean, Americans have traveled abroad, have been in all kinds of situations of war and so on and so on. But somehow, there was a kind of
protective
kind of
shield
to the
faith.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, a sanctity. I mean, quite almost in the religious sense.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, it's no longer there. And, you know, it's like awakening. You know, as Blackmore says somewhere, knowledge is a fall from the paradise of undifferentiated sensation. So sensation becomes all of a sudden highly differentiated into what is threatening, what is there, what is not there, what might be there, and so on and so forth. It requires many levels of past and present and future and visible and invisible, and that tumult is with us now in a way that I suppose it wasn't before the 11th of September. But to me, it's been there all along. And I think for most expatriates and exiles, people who have moved around, migrants, to think of them, immigrants who spend, you know, weeks trying to get out of one place into another and to new geographies, new landscapes, new sounds, new smells, and above all, new identities. I mean, that kind of world is very threatening, obviously, but for some of us, it's the only reality.
My guest today has been Edward Said. It's been a long desire of mine to spend some time talking to him, and thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you very much. Tremendous pleasure.
Great pleasure. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer was Mario Diaz. Technical assistance from Alan Howard. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.